Blog Talk Radio.
This is Silvio Canto in Dallas, Texas, on Thursday, September the 19th. And today we're going to reconnect with our good friend Barry Jacobson. We have a lot of national security issues to touch base with. There's a big crisis in Saudi Arabia, and there's a lot of debate in the media as to what the American response should be. And, well, I'm not sure what it should be, and that's why I thought it would be a good idea to check tonight with Barry, who always has a good explanation and a good answer for many of these things. I mean, on one hand, I suppose, you know, you do want to punish Iran for what they did. Apparently, if they did it, it points to them, although we're not 100% sure that they did it. I think they're still looking into it, but it looks very much like it was an Iranian operation. But then on the other hand, do you really want to go to war over Saudi Arabian oil at a time when America is self-sufficient when it comes to oil? So it's a complicated issue. It's not an easy one for President Trump to deal with, and that's why I thought it would be a good idea to check with our friend Barry Jacobson. So let me say hello to our friend Barry. Barry, how is everything in the West Coast?
Well, it's good. I mean, it's beautiful out here. It still feels like summertime, which probably does in Texas as well. Your Cowboys look good. My Rams look good. Chargers look pretty good. Life ain't bad.
That's it. Well, maybe the Cowboys and the Rams will meet again, especially now that Drew Brees hurt his hand. I mean, that's a terrible thing for New Orleans. So maybe the Rams and the Cowboys will meet again. That would be nice.
It would be, and the Cowboys are playing good football. So we haven't seen that in a while. I'm glad to see it. They are, after all, America's team, so the Cowboys need to be good. It's kind of like Notre Dame. Remember Notre Dame football used to be superb?
Yes.
And I had an Irish friend from Boston who used to say, America is only runs right when Notre Dame is playing well. And I'm not sure that he was wrong.
Right. Well, that's a good line. I like that. And I will say this about Notre Dame. I'm old enough to remember Terry Hanratty, the quarterback. So I guess that gives away my generation, doesn't it, Barry?
Indeed, indeed it does. In fact, if we can remember when the Fighting Irish were a powerhouse, that in itself gives away our age. It's been that long.
That's right. Those were great, great teams when the Big Ten was, I suppose, the best of all of the conferences. Well, before we get to Saudi Arabia, though, I did want to get your reaction. We've been hearing a great deal about President Trump being out there in L.A. over the last few days. I guess he was fundraising, and he created a little commotion. So what can you tell us about that?
I'm not sure what you're speaking of because I was so busy with the real world. I wasn't involved with local politics in the last week. But I will say this. Since I've moved to L.A., I have been going to various Republican conservative think tank seminars and dinners. For instance, I went to David Horowitz's 80th birthday party, in which Mike Huckabee was the keynote speaker. Mm-hmm. And believe it or not, Rich Little, I don't know if you remember him, but Rich Little, the impersonator, who's also 80 years old, got up and did a stand-up.
Yes, he did the best Nixon, I think, that anybody ever did.
He does a great Johnny Carson, too, but you have to be old enough to remember Johnny Carson.
Yes.
So, I've been getting kind of involved with local Republican politics, and I can tell you there's – and I work, of course, in Hollywood and work in Beverly Hills, and I brush elbows with a lot of older celebrities. Mm-hmm. And there really are a lot of Republicans and a lot of conservatives of the older crowd in L.A. They're not all far wing wackos, mm-hmm. far left wing wackos. So Trump was probably smart to come out here and boost morale and of course fundraise, because there's a lot of money to be raised out here in California, even for a Republican.
Right. Well, the truth is that I don't think President Trump will need the money so much as just chipping away a little bit at the Democrats out there. I mean, if you look back at 2016, had he been just a little bit more aggressive in California, maybe he would have won the popular vote, because the popular vote difference, which is roughly 3 million, came out exclusively out of California. I mean, the other 49 states, Trump won the popular vote, but in California, it was so lopsided. So if he could take it from 60-40 to, let's say, 56-43, let's say, out there, that could very well be a couple of million votes that could help him in winning the popular vote. So I think it's smart for him to go out there. Yeah, go ahead.
Yeah, I agree. No, you make a great point, Silvio. If Trump can't raise the tally just among never-Trumpers in the Republican ranks by 3 million votes, I mean, there's got to be about 3 million or more never-Trumpers, the Wall Street Journal mm-hmm. kind of Republicans, mm-hmm. who like Bret Stevenson, who mm-hmm. and George Will, who really are conservative but hate Trump and probably didn't vote for him in the last election. Who got to look at Warren or Biden or really any of those clowns? Buttigieg, of course, does have a chance, but Kamala Harris, and say that as bad as Trump may be to them, he's way better than these guys. And in fact, it's really an existential choice if mm-hmm. we elect one of those socialists and they enact something like the Green New Deal or some version thereof.
Mm-hmm.
Or Medicare for all, it's game over. I mean, we're going to bankrupt the United States, and even somebody as stubborn as George Will has to see that. So I think
right.
Trump is going to gain votes regardless.
Yes, well, I agree with you, and I think the best analysis of 2020 may very well be Newt Gingrich wrote something comparing 2020 to 1972, when President Nixon was reelected with 49 states and something like 62% of the popular vote. And a year before, he was trailing a lot of Democrats in the polls because, Nixon was a very effective president, but he was not a popular man. He was not an endearing kind of guy. He was not Reagan, who was very popular. And I'm beginning to think that that's the best analogy, 1972, when a lot of people made the choice that you're talking about, which is to say, yeah, we don't like Nixon, but man, this man McGovern is just not a good option. So I think that's what it's going to be. I think Trump will be reelected, and a lot of people will simply say, well, we just cannot vote for Elizabeth Warren or Bernie Sanders. I also think, by the way, once they get into the campaign and they have to start explaining their ideas and actually explaining in detail, I think a lot of their candidacies will just fall apart because they cannot explain their ideas. So, but anyway, I think it's smart of President Trump to go out to California, even if he does nothing more than just increase the share of the vote. That'll pick him, given your population out there, that'll pick him maybe a couple million votes, and that's something he can use, Barry.
A couple things about what you just said. First, you're right on the latter point. Keep in mind that when he went to Wisconsin repeatedly, everybody thought that was a fool's errand.
Mm-hmm. Yeah.
And no Republican had won Wisconsin in a very long time, and yet that ended up in his column.
Mm-hmm.
So that's, I don't think California is going to vote Trump, but I think he can gain, as you said, more popular votes, and that can make a big difference if it becomes, the popular vote becomes close. I don't think the Electoral College will be close at all. Second
no.
point is that you brought up, and I think it's a strong one, an important one to mention, is that, Trump is – he's a different kind of candidate. He's a different kind of politician.
Mm-hmm.
And like Nixon, he rubs a lot of people wrong. But also like Nixon, I think he's going to win in a landslide for the very reason you elucidated, which is that his opponent is so distasteful by comparison, not on a personal level like Trump is, but just policy-wise.
Mm-hmm.
So, but I would caution you to remember another thing. about 72. 72 led to 73 and 4, which is a president winning by a landslide victory was still very nearly impeached and forced from office. And Reagan won by another stunning landslide in 84 against Mondale and spent his whole second term fighting impeachment with Iran-Contra. So what I think the Democrats will do, regardless of who wins, well, if Trump wins, is you'll see a redo of both those results in that they will work overtime to then make his second term pretty much untenable.
Yeah, well, I think, unfortunately, you're right, because that's all they have. I just hope we can pick up the House again. If we can pick up the House, I think that'll make it a lot easier to keep all these investigations at bay, if you know what I mean. Because, I mean, the only reason they're even talking about investigations in the House is because they have majorities, and they can, you know, create these committees and all of that. They wouldn't be able to do that with if they were the minority party again. So,
That's right.
It's a long time. It's a long time to election day, as you know. A lot of things can change. A lot of things can happen. But I would say, if you know, if I was betting a cup of coffee, and that's all I ever bet, I would bet that Trump will be reelected. What happens to the House, I don't know. I'm optimistic, but I'm not sure. But I do feel that Trump will be reelected. Well, one of the big issues, Barry, and why I wanted to talk to you tonight. One of the big issues facing President Trump right now is this whole matter of Saudi Arabia. It was a pretty daring attack for someone like you who follows the military a lot. It was a pretty daring attack. I mean, they used drones to destroy a lot of the production facilities there. Now, thankfully, we don't depend on that oil anymore because we're independent of oil. But nevertheless, it did have an impact on public opinion and the price of oil and all of that. So first question is just the attack itself using drones against an oil production facility. I thought that was pretty daring. How did you evaluate that?
Well, first I would note that there's still conflicting reports. Some are still saying it was a cruise missile attack. So I'm not completely certain it was drones. They certainly came underneath the radar, and that could indicate either cruise missiles or drones. I just read today that they're looking at guidance systems of cruise missiles that were left in the debris, so I don't know. But even if these weren't drones, you know, that's a threat that's going to manifest, if not now, then soon. Drones laden with explosives. So one of the reasons we don't think it's the Houthis, or many don't think it's the Houthis in Yemen lobbing missiles, is you know, we have eye in the sky, we have a satellite flying over everywhere in the world, and I think our intelligence assets have let us know that the trajectory of these missiles came from Iran, and secondly, the precision of it was too precise to be mere area impact weapons like the Houthis tend to lob. You know, there's something more akin to the old Scuds that Iraq used, which were an area weapon. And in other words, they're not pinpoint accuracy. They just lob it into a certain area and hope for the best. These were pinpoint, and they took out exactly what they wanted to take out. So, I mean, it's a threat that we have to face. We sell a lot of weapons to Saudi Arabia. You know, they have a very high defense budget, and one wonders why we don't have some defense against this. I think Putin was joking that maybe they ought to buy a Russian air defense system. Because I mean, the Saudis spend $67 billion on defense every year. They're third ranked in the entire world. So maybe they ought to invest more money in air defense systems. I don't know.
Yeah. Well, it's interesting the point you raised, because if it was guided missiles, then that would make it more certain, at least in my mind, that they came from a country that has those kinds of missiles, meaning Iran. So that's, I think, more scary. Drones would suggest that it was more of a something like a 9/11 attack, where a bunch of people, you know, were acting by themselves. But if it's missiles, then I would think that makes the situation a lot more serious, because they can do it again, number one. They can also hit Israel, number two. And And number three, I mean, they could be more destructive the next time around, Barry. And one more thing I'll say, it's amazing to me that Saudi Arabia was not better prepared for an attack like this. I mean, with, like you say, with all the money they've spent on the military, I mean, how they didn't have defense systems is beyond me, Bill, Barry. I said a lot there,
and
so.
And
kind of gave you a mouthful there. A lot to talk about.
First of all, we've sold them 6 battalions of Patriot surface-to-air missiles, the Raytheon system. But apparently we're not sure if those were even on location to defend these sites. You know, where they're defending, I don't know. So it could be, you know, their defense strategy is flawed. Perhaps they're defending their cities. Perhaps they're putting place in these around their Air Force bases. Who knows? But they weren't. There's at least some speculation they were not guarding the coastal sites where these refineries are. And apparently the refineries had the coastal defenses expecting some sort of seaborne attack, such as small boats coming swiftly from the Gulf and landing, and commando teams then piling out and making a ground assault. They were well defended against those, but not against low-level air attack, low elevation, such as cruise missiles. But, you know, this is the threat of the future. It's not just the Saudis are going to worry about this, but really everyone has to worry about it. Even our fleet has to be able to defend against surface skimming missiles. You know, the Gulf waters aren't that big. Our 5th Fleet is based in Bahrain. So this is a threat, you know, that we have to look forward to. So at some point during this conversation, I would probably like to throw in my long-held belief of what we need to do against Iran. But let's continue.
Yeah, no, that's hopefully that's the climax of our show today. What you're going to say about Iran, let's look at President Trump's options at the moment. You're hearing a lot of different things, as you normally do at a time like this. I was listening to Lindsey Graham, who's pretty good on national security. He was saying, well, you just cannot allow this or anybody to get away with this. And then you have others who are saying, well, you know, let's not jump into a war. So if you're, let's say you were talking to President Trump tonight, what would you tell him to do, Barry?
I would tell him to do what he probably does not want to do, which is make a surgical strike to take out Iranian assets and lessen their capability. You can't change the regime without a lot more military and political action than we are prepared to do right now. That should be our long-term goal, and that is going to take a lot of diplomatic and political preparation, so something's ready to step into the vacuum left if and when that regime collapses. But there's things we can do in the short term. When they took our naval vessel hostage a couple years back during Obama's administration, I think I was on your show and I proposed what I would still propose today, which is this: that the Iranian Navy is a gunboat Navy. It's a coastal Navy. I would be astonished if we don't know exactly where every one of their naval assets are at any given time and where their naval harbors and bases are. I would make a sudden and devastating surgical strike from the air, from the sea, on all their naval coastal installations. Take out their entire coastal facilities, take out their Navy, put them all on the bottom. I would also take out any of their coastal missile sites and airfields. And their main oil terminal, their main oil refinery is on the coast. I would take that out as well, crippling their oil infrastructure. And then I would give them an ultimatum. I'd say, we're going to stop at this point, but the next strike, if you continue to be belligerent, if you want to retaliate, go ahead. But the next strike, we're going to take down your entire energy infrastructure. We're going to black out Iran, take all your energy away, and you're going to be basically back in the Stone Age using candles. No power, no power grid, nothing.
Mm-hmm.
And we certainly have the technology to do that.
Right. Now, I mean, I actually like what you're saying, because I think these kinds of attacks you have to respond to what Iran did. But explain to me. Let me do this. Let me take a break, And then when we come back, let's talk a little bit about how we actually would accomplish militarily, and maybe maybe if you can explain to us what would an attack be like, and what are some of the resources that we would use to accomplish some of those things that you are saying. So let me take a break, and then when we come back, we'll get into maybe a little explanation of what an attack would look like, let's say, to take out their grid or take out their military operations. So let's take a little break. I want you to hear from my friend Carlos Geddes, and then we'll be right back with Barry.
Carlos Geddes Harpies. I would like to see you guys this Saturday night at Tzatziki's at the Star, located at 6765 Winning Drive in Frisco. I'll be performing instrumental high energy music at 6:30 until 9:30 p.m. Make your reservation today at 972-377-2276. Remember, Tzatziki's at the Star is the place to hang out on Saturday night. For upcoming dates, look for me on Facebook, Twitter, and Instagram.
And we have a link to Carlo's website on the show information. So if you click on that, it'll take you to his entire schedule for the month of September. And you'll have a chance to go out to eat and enjoy some of the great music that he plays. And we play some of that music on the show. In fact, the tunes that you hear on our show are courtesy of my good friend Carlos Geddes. Let's get back to Barry Jacobson. We're talking about Iran. Okay, Barry, so we decide to carry out these strikes. What would an attack look like? What kind of resources and how long would it take to accomplish, let's say, what you're talking about?
Well, the combination of cyber warfare and military strikes by American aircraft based in the Gulf, or in some cases based in the United States, such as the B-2s, the stealth bomber, we could take out probably their entire Navy within a matter of less than a week. Most would be taken out in the first day or two. We have submarines, we have destroyers and other kinds of warships, surface warships that have cruise missiles and guns that could bombard the coast. And of course, we have aircraft carriers with a whole ton of munitions on board those planes. Every one of those aircraft carriers, those Nimitz class or larger aircraft carriers, have as many strike aircraft as most nations of the world have in their entire arsenal. That's a single carrier. We could massively bombard and coming in low over the Gulf and take out their coastal facilities. And cyber warfare could take down a lot more. I'm not an expert on cyber warfare by any means. But between that and strikes on their secondary strikes, if they continue, if the hostilities continue on their grid, could probably take down their power grid within the first week or two. I don't know if we have EMP devices. My guess is we probably do, but we wouldn't need them. We just need to strike their communications and energy hubs and take those out with kinetic munitions.
Now, how would they respond? I mean, what kind of damage could they do back to us, Barry?
All right. So the reason I phase in two phases, first phase, take out their Navy and take out their refinery, is then you hold back the steel gauntlet for a second strike and give them an option. If they want to retaliate, they can. But then we take out their power grid. Then we put them back in total darkness. But here's what they could do. They control proxy armies on Israel's border, both Hamas and Hezbollah to the north in Lebanon. And direct Iranian forces based out of Syria could attack our ally Israel. They also have Houthis, who are a proxy army in Yemen, who could continue lobbing missiles and maybe make low-level, low-grade attacks on Saudi targets. They have assets in Iraq, and we have American troops in Iraq. They could unleash a Shiite militia, which they have under their control. Remember the old Sadr militia out of Baghdad?
Mm-hmm. Mm-hmm.
And there are probably other Shia militias in Iraq. They can unleash those against American targets or American allies, either with IEDs or suicide attacks, artillery or mortar strikes on our bases. Could they make a you know, could they wage war symmetrically with us, with their army and their force against ours? No, they wouldn't stand a chance against even Saudi Arabia, probably. Saudi Arabia has a more powerful force, conventional force. But they have terrorist assets all across the so-called Shia Crescent, which starts on one end, starts in Lebanon, and then goes right across the Middle East all the way to Yemen in a big crescent shape. And all throughout that, they have proxy armies they can unleash. And let's not discount the possibility of sleeper cells in the United States that can unleash terrorism within the United States. Our southern border is completely unprotected. It's completely open. We've caught, you know, Africans crossing the United States. We've caught Chinese crossing the United States. We've caught Middle Eastern folks, some of which have been identified as terrorists. We've caught them, but who's to say who we haven't caught? So, you know, Iran is not without claws. They're not without the ability to strike back. But they'd have to think twice, because we could take out their power grid and, you know, leave them in basically, you know, looking at everything, reading everything by candlelight, if we wish to.
Right, right. Now, what about, because one of the issues is always, you know, what about Israel? Remember during the first Gulf War that Iraq, with those missiles back then, the Scud missiles, they tried to get Israel into the war by attacking them. How quickly do you think Israel or Iran would attack Israel? Do you think that's a possibility? And all of a sudden, the Israelis are in the war too.
Yes, I think that's exactly what they would do. I think they would attack through using Hezbollah and perhaps Iranian forces in southern Syria to attack, you know, northern Israel, and they'd probably use Hamas to try to make suicide or other kinds of terrorist attacks, certainly launching rockets from Gaza. And Israel might retaliate. Israel might use that opportunity, and probably wisely, to make surgical strikes on the Iranian nuclear capabilities, whatever nuclear sites Israel identifies. Of course, a lot's going to depend on who the prime minister of Israel is. Israel's going through right now their own political crisis. And it also depends when this happens. If Trump is president, one thing happens. If you know, Trump doesn't get reelected and we have, say, President Elizabeth Warren, then who knows, you know, what would happen. But just for here and now, with Bibi in Israel and Trump in the White House, I think we could win this conflict and at least temporarily bring Iran to its knees.
Right. Well, I would think Israel could help us a great deal by taking out some of these groups, you know, that could be a threat to Israel and the U.S. forces as well, Barry.
I think the long-term strategy, though, is got to be more comprehensive. And something I've been advocating on your show and to friends and people I've talked to is the formation of a Sunni Arab NATO. Basically, a NATO comprised of the Sunni nations that are friendly to the United States, more or less. You can argue whether Saudi Arabia is a real friend, but form a NATO which the United States would lead, but the ground forces would be the forces of Jordan, Saudi Arabia, Egypt, Iraq. You know what there is of Iraq that's constituted is not in other hands. And this NATO would be led by United States generals. We'd provide some air assets, not necessarily ground assets, though perhaps special ops, and let the Sunni organize so that instead of Iran with all of its proxies attacking one at a time, like attacking today they're attacking Saudi Arabia, maybe tomorrow they're attacking Jordan, let the Sunnis band together and defend themselves with American help as a united coalition. Now, that's something, by the way, which should have been done a long time ago. I don't know why it's waited this long and still, in fact, has not happened. It just makes way too much sense.
Yeah. Well, I don't want to get too partisan, but I do feel that the Obama presidency set back many of these objectives. I mean, I think we were in a much stronger position in the Middle East when President Bush turned things over to President Obama in early 2009. And I think under President Obama, a lot of things were allowed to happen. And I'm not trying to blame it all on Obama, but you know, he was willing to, I think, the Iran nuclear deal, for example, which was a disaster, you know, not allowing Syria to cross that line that he drew. I just think that we took some steps back under the Obama presidency, and that, you know, some of these problems stem from that, Barry.
Well, they certainly do, and giving billions of dollars,
yes,
tens of billions of dollars to Iran as part of that deal we made,
mm-hmm,
that ill-conceived deal, is one of the things we're seeing. One of the fruits of that is what we're seeing today. We're seeing,
right,
increased Iranian activities all throughout the Middle East because they can now fund more terrorist organizations.
Yeah, I have no idea what they were thinking when they gave them all those billions of dollars. It's just beyond me. I have no idea why we would have to pay them that much money to sign an Iran nuclear deal. You know, if the deal was that good, why did we have to pay them all that money, Barry?
Well, the argument was, you know, you'll still hear Democrats saying this, was that that was their money. That was money that was frozen in American banks when the Shah fell.
Yes,
Iranian assets are frozen. But so what? That money should have been still kept in reserve or escrow pending the outcome of lawsuits by various Americans against Iran. And then the proceeds,
mm-hmm,
of those judgments should have been paid out of those assets to American families who've been the victims of Iranian terror.
It's like with Cuba, with all of the properties that were expropriated, they're in the courts, and they, you know, all of those dollars should have been left in the courts and let the courts, different trials and all of that, decide what to do with all that money. I think to arbitrarily take it and give it to Iran, like President Obama did, I just thought it was a bad idea at the time. And the Iran nuclear deal itself, I mean, they couldn't get that through the Senate. They couldn't get a treaty, because they couldn't even get Democrats to support it, Barry.
Because it was obvious that what that agreement did, Sylvia, was give Iran a pause at best. But then at the end of that period of the treaty, which was only 15 years, give them the blessing, essentially, to develop their nuclear program. It never bound Iran to forswear developing nuclear weapons. It only put it on a delay. And on top of that, you know, a lot of experts will say, and a lot of so-called experts will say, Iran was not violating that treaty when Donald Trump abrogated it and canceled it. But we don't know, because the treaty was so flawed, it didn't allow us to inspect any of the key sites, any of the military sites where they could be developing nuclear weapons. So they could have been cheating in the sense of, you know, the spirit of the agreement without ever violating the letter of the law, because we weren't allowed to inspect.
That's right. Well, I still say, you know, I remember talking to you about this a few years ago, 2014, 2015, when that deal was made, and I kept going back to the same question, and that is, why wasn't this submitted to the U.S. Senate as a treaty and debated on the floor of the Senate like a treaty? And that's because I think the Obama administration knew that it would never pass, that there were so many holes in that Iran nuclear deal that it would never get out of the Senate, Barry.
Well, exactly so. And Obama did many treaties like that, did not send them to the Senate, just basically passed them almost like an executive decision.
Right, executive agreements, yeah.
Executive, yeah. And so when those things work fine while you're president, but they're meant to expire when you leave office. And in fact, they did. They should have.
Right. That's the same thing with, you know, with the Paris Climate Change Accords and of course, the most famous one, DACA, as well. They're just executive agreements that when you're out of, you know, they work great, like you say, when you're in office, but the minute you leave, the next guy doesn't have to abide by it. And that's the difference between a treaty and an executive agreement. Had he had a treaty with Iran or with the Paris Climate Change, Trump couldn't touch it because they're treaties. But, you know, that's another issue. That's the way President Obama chose to govern. And I think, ironically, it hurt his legacy because he's got nothing on his resume that he ever did, Barry.
Yeah, except divide the country. I mean, it's also
his legacy,
he left the country more divided than when he found it.
Oh, absolutely. No question.
It is not to wax too far off topic and wax too partisan, but the country, when the country elected its first black president, one would think that the result of 8 years of that would be a country that's had a chance to heal some of its racial divides.
Mm-hmm.
I mean, what could be more proof of that we're not a, quote, racist country than that we elect a black man as president? And yet that's not the case. And it's not the case because Obama didn't really want it to be the case. He uses presidency it's not the wedge issue.
Well, I think you're right. In fact, I remember, Barry, the night that he was elected, the very next day, I wrote a blog post at American Thinker where I said, look, I'm not happy with the results, but this may actually turn out to be good for the country to have our first black president. It could heal some of the wounds, you know, and maybe help us come together. But he did the exact opposite. I think he divided the country more than ever, and I thought Attorney General Eric Holder was terrible in that respect as well. And anyway, that's not our topic, but I think you're exactly right, and you're saying that he divided the country. Well, anything else that you want to say about Iran? I mean, obviously, this is something that I'd like to have you back on, you know, later if there's any further development. But what else would you like to say about Iran tonight that we have not touched?
Well, I think that Iran is a festering, festering ulcer that will just get worse.
Mm-hmm.
At some point, we're going to have to deal with Iran, whether we deal with them now or later, under this president or the next. It's like North Korea.
Mm-hmm.
Every administration from at least Clinton onward kept kicking that can down the road and making accommodations, mm-hmm. and nothing seemed to work. That the regime kept cheating on them. Iran is just getting more powerful. There's Iranian influence even as far as South America.
Mm-hmm.
They're propping up the Venezuelan regime. I've heard of Iranian assets active in Paraguay. So, how long we're going to let this go on is questionable, and it's to our own peril if we let it go on too much longer.
That's right.
Iran, I like what Trump is doing as far as the so-called maximum pressure campaign. We are crippling their economy, and we need to
mm-hmm.
keep that up. But we need to have a strategy that ultimately changes that regime, not just punishes the regime, not just makes their life uncomfortable. And I don't think we've had that strategy for a very long time, at least one that we were ready to fully implement. At some point, the Iranian people will rise up only, I think, if somebody is willing to back them with weapons and possibly even troops. And I'm not advocating invading Iran to liberate Iran from the mullahs, because that could well backfire on us, uniting the Iranians behind the regime. But when those people rise up again, as they did during the first year, I think it was, of the Obama administration,
we need to
do more than simply give lip service to supporting them.
That's right. Well, yeah, we remember back in the summer of 2009 or in the fall of 2009 when they were in the streets. And, they could have used our help, and they didn't get any help. And that's I thought, one of the most shameful things that President Obama did in looking the other way.
You're old enough to remember, at least from the history books, when they still taught history in school, something they don't really much anymore. It's gone out of fashion, but you remember in 56, was it, or 55, when the Soviet tanks rolled through Budapest?
That's right, in Hungary,
We did nothing. We encouraged Prime Minister Nagy to break the Soviet chains, and then did nothing to support him when he did. He ended up being put up against the wall and shot.
Mm-hmm, yeah.
We need to do something more than give sympathy and support, lip service. We need to, whether it's weapons, whether it's CIA-backed, aid, special operations units, something to train a real resistance, kind of like we did in the 60s, early 60s, supposedly with Cuba.
Mm-hmm.
But then, of course, Kennedy pulled the plug on Bay of Pigs. But something more like that, where we're training Iranian resistance fighters to eventually become a shadow government and possibly be ready to help liberate that country.
That's right. No, I think I agree with you 100%. Hungary was in, I think, November of 1956. The other day I was talking to some gentlemen who left Hungary at that time. And it was very interesting to look back at that crisis. Eisenhower was president, I believe, at the time. Well, Barry, I want to thank you so much for giving us your input on short notice. I really appreciate that, and I hope you, I hope we can do this again soon, because I think this is not the last time we'll be talking about Iran. I think something is going to happen here in the next few weeks, and when it does, I'd love to have you back.
Well, you know, next year is the election year, and there'll be plenty of interesting
plenty
things
of time.
To talk about.
And by
the
way,
the Chinese may be cursed to live in interesting times. We live in interesting times.
We sure do.
We are so
cursed. And that's right. And as many of your fans in your Facebook page as well as your blog know, that from time to time I've been running these series that we did on World War One and World War Two, and I really enjoyed them. And they sound, you know, they're like a bottle of wine. They get better with age, you know. So these series are great, and I enjoy them a lot. And I'm so grateful that you gave us your time to do them. I keep putting them, you know, I try to put them in some kind of sequence, but sometimes I don't. But anyway, they're still very interesting. And I want to thank
you
so much for having me.
Well, you know, I do share those, and I'm very proud of the work we did. We came up with some pretty entertaining podcasts that, you know, take complex, you know, scenarios and complex issues of World War II and the origins of World War One and such, and make them understandable and enjoyable.
That's right. And if people could only understand that every once in a while we would talk about the Eagles or the Dallas Cowboys, if they can put up with that, I think they'll enjoy the podcast.
Exactly so. Well, you have a great evening. It's a pleasure talking to you as always.
Thank you so much. Our good friend Barry Jacobson, we have a link to Barry's page on the show information. Check it out. I loved what Barry said tonight about options, and we'll have to keep an eye on what President Trump does. But as I mentioned the other night when I talked about this, President Trump is probably not going to act right away. He's going to take his time and look at other options. But if he does act, it's going to be very decisive and very devastating for Iran. So that's just my feeling. I just think that President Trump is not going to fool around. If he acts, it's going to be a deadly punch, as they say in boxing. Good night, everybody. This is Silvio Canto in Dallas.